This HedgeGhoul series of podcasts is brought to you by History Ireland Magazine and the Wardwell Group. For more information or to subscribe, visit historyireland.com. Greetings, history lovers, and welcome to the latest History Ireland HedgeGhoul with editor Tommy Graham in the chair. Regular readers of History Ireland will recall a very striking front cover on our July-August 2021 issue depicting suffragette and socialist Margaret Buckmaster in a long white apron bearing the slogan, quote, "We English protest," unquote. This was at a 2nd of July 1921 demonstration organised by the Peace with Ireland Council, the PIC, and the Women's Franchise League. How significant were such anti-colonial solidarity movements in Britain in the revolutionary period? How effective were they? To address these and related questions, I'm joined by regular HedgeGhoul panellist Darragh Gannon, lecturer in Irish Studies at UCD, and author of Conflict, Diaspora and Empire, Irish Nationalism in Great Britain, 1912 to 1922. And that was published this year by Cambridge University Press. Angus Mitchell, who has published widely on anti-war activism in the early 20th century and is author of The Casement Memorial Statue. And that will be published by Dunleary and Rathdown County Council in May 2022. Finally, Mo Moulton, senior lecturer in the History of Race and Empire at the University of Birmingham, and author of Ireland and the Irish in Interwar England, and that was published by Cambridge University Press in 2014. And this HedgeGhoul is supported by the Department of Foreign Affairs Reconciliation Fund. Now, Angus, let me go to you first, because would I be right in assuming that the Casement Amnesty campaign in 1916 was to some extent a template for future solidarity campaigns?
Well, Tommy, I think it, in a way it's right to call it a clemency campaign. But yes, a lot of different forces and vectors came together to try and stop Britain hanging Casement in the middle of the First World War. And a lot of those were people who had in different ways been involved in colonial reform politics. That was from the left, most obviously, a lot of Labour figures. There were a lot of women involved, a lot of Irish nationalists, and a lot of guild socialists too, people who had advocated for a different form of socialism around the arts and crafts movements, and interesting pleas within the Asquith papers at Oxford to do with those guild groups. So yeah, it is right to talk about different colonial forces and anti-colonial forces coming together around Casement's execution. But I also think you need to set it in a deeper context, in really extending from the famine and through the late 19th century, which sees Ireland gradually becoming aware of the kind of political potential, in a way, of anti-colonialism, which is certainly after the Boer War fused very deliberately with the nationalist cause and used as a way by which kind of visibility is given to different sides of the Irish nationalist camp.
Now, of course, that Casement campaign was during wartime. Mo, can I bring you in here? Because how many conscientious objectors were there to the First World War? Because it's in kind of the same territory here. I mean, were they a tiny minority? You know, what sort of difficulties did people like that face?
Sure, absolutely, yeah. I mean, in Britain, conscientious objection was punished pretty severely. And so it was a tiny minority of people who chose to be proper conscientious objectors, and they faced considerable sanctions for doing that. I would echo, though, what Angus said there about the prevalence of ideas about opposing war as such, the idea of pacifism, and how that becomes important within feminists and suffrage groups and other groups who really see World War I as a kind of rallying cry, a rallying point, and who form organizations that then are seeking to ensure peace and a different kind of global order after World War I.
Now, there was a different atmosphere, obviously, after war, which I'll get back to you on Mo, but before I do that, I just want to go to Darragh. just to give us a picture of the Irish in Britain. I have a figure in my head of, you know, the 1 million Irish born in Britain, but we're also second, third generation. Did people, Irish people, either, you know, first, second or third generation, did they get organized or were they under pressure, you know, to keep their head down, their heads down, Dara?
So the Irish population in Great Britain was quite considerable at the end of the First World War. And the best estimate that we have is that 1.5 million of Irish birth, but also second, third generation Irish, were resident in Great Britain by 1921. So there's a significant diaspora population which had the potential to contribute to public discourse about Ireland, especially during the revolutionary period. But it is important to bear in mind, to your question, that there had always been a reluctance of the majority of the Irish to engage in overt participation in Irish nationalist politics. So the Home Rule representative organisation, the United Irish League of Great Britain, reached its peak in 1914 with only 47,000 members. And of course, Home Rule was eminently more respectable in this period than revolutionary politics. If you look at 1919, then we see the establishment of the Irish Self-Determination League, which was in essence, the political successor to the Home Rule movement in the form of Sinn Féin politics. But even as early as November 1919, about 8 months into its organization, it had only 3,823 members in England and Wales. And in 1921, there's 364,000 Irish born in England and Wales, according to the census. So Irish political participation amounts to about 1%, which is really quite jarring when we think about it. Now, there are a couple of reasons for this. The ISDL, as it was known for short, was explicitly for those of Irish birth or descent. So it excluded, for example, members of the British Labour Party. It excluded, denominational groups who are interested in contributing. And it was also avowedly Gaelic revivalist. It was led by Art O'Brien in London, where it had its main political presence, and he was opposed to integration into British society. He espoused the Gaelic language, and he had basically towed the Sinn Féin party line. Now, there's a second importance, I think, which is really important to stress here in regards to Irish nationalist organisations in Britain. And Michael Hopkinson has raised a very salient point that with the destruction of the Irish Parliamentary Party at the 1918 general election, there were only seven IPP MPs at Westminster, and also the refusal of Sinn Féin to attend Westminster, there was a gaping vacuum in British political discourse in terms of publicity for the Irish cause, because there was not a significant representation at the House of Commons. And in theory, Irish nationalists in Great Britain could solve that issue for Dáil Éireann. And so the ISDL comes under great pressure from Eamon de Valera, Erskine Childers and Desmond Fitzgerald, who are leading the Dáil Department of Propaganda, to basically replace the de facto publicity at Westminster through the ISDL. And they struggle to do this for the aforementioned reasons, but one of the great success stories that they have, in the early period at least, is on the 11th of February 1920, when they stage a mass rally at the Albert Hall, which of course is one of the sites of kind of British representations of imperialism, certainly in the capital. And this is attended by 10,000 people. It's addressed by Arthur Griffith and other nationalist leaders. But I think it's quite interesting to note the reactions of the British press and the British people in, you know, the heart of empire. The Irish Independence London correspondent reports the curiosity of the London crowds when they see contingents formed up in processional order and with Republican flags flying as they're leaving the West End after a night's entertainment. And you also see that in the press. The Times, the Daily Herald, the Daily Express are all struck by this Sinn Féin flag flying over the Royal Albert Hall. So by early 1920, there is a significant publicity and propaganda raison d'etre for Irish nationalists in Britain.
Now, is the name significant, Dara, Self-Determination League?
It is significant because by definition, it marks a change in the stated political organisation previously to that, the United Irish League of Great Britain. And the Irish Self-Determination League, of course, was given its title by Eamon de Valera in March of 1919, when he directly instructed Art O'Brien to set up the ISDL in London, but also in other centres. So the initial aim really, in terms of strategy, was to try and put pressure on the Allies at the Paris Peace Conference by using the kind of the lingua franca of the day, self-determination. And of course, perhaps most importantly, in the British political context, the issue of republic, of course, is highly contested. It's a highly partisan term. And so many nationalists in Dublin felt that that would be too hot of a topic to raise in terms of title. So they stuck with Irish Self-Determination League.
And that formula was copied then in other British dominions, like in Canada and Australia and so on, was it not?
Exactly. And this form is a part of what we've termed previously brand nationalism. So it's really important that we see the transnational context to this as well, the self-determination leagues in Australia, Canada and New Zealand.
Now, just like, did the ISDL then operate in an Irish bubble to some extent?
I think it certainly did. Certainly in London, where Arthur Bryan, who I mentioned before, who was the Dáil envoy to Great Britain, the unofficial envoy, of course, who was this kind of ardent Gaelic revivalist and essentially a Sinn Féin separatist. But he and others recognised that many Irish in Great Britain did not necessarily agree with the idea of the Irish Republic, and perhaps they needed a more moderate form of title and of politics in their stated political objective. But nonetheless, I think part of the issue that the ISDL had was that it was resistant at leadership level to engaging with British political parties, most notably the British Labour Party, who were perhaps most receptive to the idea of staging publicity rallies during the War of Independence.
Okay, I'm assuming it might be a different matter at rank and file level, but we'll come back to that in a second, Dara. Mo, I want to go to Angus to talk about the Peace in Ireland Council, but before we do, just talk to us a little bit about the broader context in Britain, you know, post-1918.
Sure, absolutely, yeah. So, I mean, as the discussion you were just having about the name Self-Determination League kind of indicates, this is a moment where there's a lot of conversation going on about really the global order. This has been characterized as the Wilsonian moment by some folks. This notion that World War One, the Great War, was fought for the rights of small nations to self-determination. And that leads to a lot of conversation about how should the world be organized? And maybe the big question for Britain really is, what is the future of the British Empire in the context of a world organized around national self-determination or the goal of national self-determination? And I think one of the most interesting things about this moment is that this isn't just a conversation that's happening at the level of high politics, right? This isn't just something that's happening in Geneva or in Whitehall. These are conversations that ordinary people are participating in all sorts of ways. So the organizations that we're talking about today are part of a landscape of associational groups with branches around the country. There are widespread, the League of Nations Union has branches around Britain. All of these organizations have these branches, and they are places where ordinary people see themselves as participating in an effort to prevent future wars, and also to think through how should Britain be in the world in future? Should Britain be willing to cede territory as part of a larger project of a self-determining world? So that I think these conversations should really be placed in a context of the start of thinking through decolonization and the emergence of a kind of anti-colonialism within Britain as well as beyond Britain.
Now, am I right in assuming that wartime censorship would have been lifted, so it was easier to have such discussions?
Yes, absolutely. It was much easier to have such discussions. And they were really, the first few years after World War One were the moments when a lot of this stuff was being worked out. So the League of Nations was being set up, the mandate system was being created, and there was this a series of anti-colonial uprisings, demonstrations around the British Empire. So this was something that was really in the forefront of people's minds as they were making use of that kind of more free context, I guess, to talk about these things.
Now, Angus, I want to move on and talk about the Peace in Ireland Council, because I've suggested that with the lifting of wartime censorship, that it was easier to have these type of, you know, anti-colonial, anti-imperial discussions. But not necessarily, Angus. I mean, just talk to us a little bit about why the PIC was founded.
Well, I think the PIC was partly founded for some of the reasons or the gaps, if you like, that Dara made evident when he just spoke. And in some ways, the actual establishing its foundations isn't easy, because a lot of the people involved didn't really want to be recognized as being part of that movement. But what you do see is that there are two figures who really emerge.
When was it founded, Angus?
It's founded officially at the end of 1920. In October 1920, there's a big meeting in Central Hall in Westminster. And Sir John Simon, Horace Plunkett, and a number of other sort of dignitaries involved with Westminster and Irish nationalism speak. And also Erskine Childers made a quick visit to London during those days to organize things on another kind of level. But the main figures who emerge are Basil Williams, who had known Erskine Childers since the Boer War times, who was a kind of major organizer behind the scenes. George Barclay, who also had been involved with the Hoth gun running and with organizing the Irish Volunteers in Belfast in 1914. And then they started to collaborate with a number of parliamentarians, Henry Cavendish Bentinck, who was a conservative, a slightly disaffected conservative MP. And then, of course, the very controversial figure of Oswald Mosley, who at that time was relatively moderate, was becoming very dissatisfied with the coalition government and had in fact left the Conservative Party in 1920 and then threw in his lot with the Peace with Ireland Council. And what they did was essentially started to organize meetings across the country to draw attention to what was really happening in Ireland, because many people felt that there was a tremendous level of censorship in the press about the true situation, and also a very misrepresentative politics around the Irish cause. And so their essential intentions were really to acquire and disseminate accurate information on the state of Ireland and to appeal to public opinion to vindicate the fundamental British principles of law and order, because as they saw it, the whole policy of reprisals that had been in place since the middle of 1920 and then most violently after this, the Balbriggan incident and all these kind of tit-for-tat atrocities was building a very sort of deep level of concern in Britain about how that war was being conducted. And so the Peace with Ireland Council come in order to arrange at quite a grassroots level much of the time, but they also do high-level events, and they begin to really try and, as they see it, redress the balance over what is known and not known about Ireland towards the end of that year. And of course, what's interesting there is that within a few days of their official beginning in October 1920, Terence McSweeney dies on hunger strike, and then you have the burning of Cork City. And those obviously are incidents that really do strike the public imagination in a whole number of ways, both in Britain and globally. And then at the beginning of 1921, Alice Stopford Green's niece, Edith Stopford, who's a young fresh down from Cambridge, very able figure, starts to organize. And Mo has written a really excellent essay looking at how that fusion between suffrage organization and Irish nationalism begins to become increasingly vocal and indeed powerful at a political level. And then, of course, a figure like Margaret Buckmaster, who was one of many women who had joined the fight, but certainly not the most the best known at that time. But obviously, that photograph it really indicates the fact that they were prepared to, wear very visibly their support for Ireland, and the fact that many English people were really seriously opposed to the whole cycle of reprisals. That
it's interesting, Angus. I got that image from the French National Archives. So I because I'd never seen it before until we published it last year. Because it's an absolutely amazing photograph. You know, it sums up the whole thing. But it's interesting that it ended up in the French National Archives. It wasn't, you know, in Britain or Ireland. Angus, just one thing. Like, was the PIC an explicitly English organization? And if so, why?
Yeah, it tried to be. I mean, it really did set up in opposition to being sort of identified in any way with Sinn Féin.
But so it's like a mirror image of the ISDL then, in that sense.
Yeah, in some ways. And I must say, I think it's very interesting listening to Dara, because I wonder how far you can really talk about the ISDL without talking about peace with Ireland Council. But I think it's also important to note that a lot of the principal figures involved in the peace with Ireland Council were were Irish, were certainly identified with Ireland. So Erskine Childers being the obvious one. I think Erskine Childers had a much larger role in the founding of the Peace with Ireland Council. And then also Alice Stopford Green, who published at least one pamphlet through the Peace with Ireland Council. And then a figure like Robert Lind, who did do quite considerable amount of public speaking on behalf of the Peace with Ireland Council, and also published a few leaflets with them. And of course, he had been involved with republicanism and Bulmer Hobson and the whole sort of Dungannon Club movement in Belfast since about 1905. So you have all these different strands, essentially, of nationalism and republicanism covertly kind of operating through, I think, the Peace with Ireland Council. So it's not as sort of squeaky clean and English as some have made out. But certainly the public persona of it was that it was very much a kind of front of English support for Ireland.
And not just any old English support. I mean, they're pretty highly connected, and dare I say, even aristocratic elements. I mean, Margaret Buckmaster herself, for example.
Well, Margaret Buckmaster, of course, was the daughter of Lord Buckmaster, who had been the Lord Chancellor in 1915 and 1916, and before the resignation of Asquith at the end of that year. And yeah, very interesting figure. Lord Bryce, who, of course, had put his name to the report into German atrocities in Belgium in 1915, although that was the year the report was published. He also was quite vocal, wrote letters to the newspapers and in support of the Peace with Ireland Council. And of course, at that initial meeting in October 1920, it was very interesting because there was a big photograph projected onto the wall in Central Hall in Westminster, and it said something like, this is not Belgium in 1914, this is Ireland in 1920. And it was a photograph of the burning of Mallow Town Hall. So there was a very deliberate effort within the Peace with Ireland Council to correlate or connect the tragedy and the atrocities happening in Ireland with the earlier politics pre-war and during the war that accreted around atrocities.
Now, Dara, I just want to move on to something slightly different. How important was the print media in this type of agitation?
It was really vitally important, I think. Certainly in the post-war period, we have the emergence of mass democracy through the Representation of the People Act in 1918, which not only gives women the right to vote, but which basically expands the electorate, not only in Ireland, but in Great Britain itself. And so British political parties, the Conservatives, the Liberals and the Labour Party, are thinking about new and innovative ways to try and capture the quote-unquote silent majority, those who would otherwise not have been able to vote for their party before. And so this is kind of an open and really bewildering period for British political parties to try and gain traction among this new electorate. And then side by side with that, as has been mentioned, and as I think been best described by Maurice Walsh in his book, The News from Ireland, we have that tradition from the First World War where censorship basically attached the British press to the state, as this is the view from the mainstream, that many British journalists were seen to be war reporters in the best interests of the state rather than objective and independent journalism. And so many of the liberal press tried to kind of distance themselves in 1919 and 1920 from that tag of having been an adjunct to the British state. And as Maurice Walsh kind of details, Hugh Martin of the Daily News is one of those kind of investigative reporters who travelled over to Ireland in 1920 and began reporting independently of the British state line about what was taking place on the ground. And I think to a certain extent, there was an element of graded exposure to the ongoing war of independence in the British press over the course of 1920. Now, one of the figures which I think is perhaps been underwritten in the historiography to date, who espouses this kind of independent journalism is Charles Diamond. And Diamond was born in Derry, but he moved to Tyneside, the Newcastle area, in the 1870s. And he laid claim to quite a remarkable newspaper empire by the turn of the century. 35 editions of his Catholic Herald newspapers were published weekly. And they basically were the best representation of Irish Catholic news in Britain throughout this period. But they were also very clearly identified with Irish nationalism. And Diamond is an interesting figure in his own right. He stood as an anti-Parnellite MP for North Monaghan between 1892 to 1895. But at the same time, he was an avowed integrationist. So he supported, for example, labour policy in Ireland. And he wanted the Irish in Britain to seek a better life for themselves in British cities. But what's most interesting is that he undergoes a remarkable transformation in terms of his response to advanced Irish nationalism over this period. So in 1916, when news of the Rising filters through to British cities, Diamond is at the forefront of criticism, most notably, in fact, of Roger Casement. He details the Rising as a stab in the back, and he claims that Casement's involvement, because of his connections to Germany, are, quote, the most sinister complexion of the Rising, unquote. However, by 1920, his tune has changed somewhat, and he publishes a remarkable article in January of 1920 called Killing No Murder. And in this article, he basically critiques the British policy in Ireland in response to the IRA's attempted assassination of Lord French, who was, of course, the Viceroy, and the IRA had attempted to assassinate Lord French in Phoenix Park in December of 1919. And he basically says, killing is no murder when it is the other fellow who is to be killed, but killing very clearly is very awful murder if we ourselves are in danger. The life of Lord French is no more than the life of any Irish peasant. He represents in Ireland nothing but foreign power, physical force, tyranny, and brutality, unquote. This is a remarkable interrogation of British policy in Ireland, again, in January of 1920, well in advance of some of the other British commentators of which we've heard. And this, of course, provokes a response, which I think attests to what you were saying earlier, Tommy, in terms of the kind of the censorship of wartime, at least. So Diamond is sensationally arrested at his London residence on the 9th of January under the Defence of the Realm regulations, and with the charge that he did unlawfully solicit, encourage and persuade to murder diverse persons in Ireland on the basis of this article. And he's transferred to the Old Bailey, where he's tried, and he's sentenced to 6 months at Pentonville Prison, of course, where Roger Casement had been in 1920. And it's quite interesting how he uses the media to his advantage again. He says this is transferring Dublin Castle methods to Britain. And so it's quite remarkable that Diamond's case, I think, really highlights the complexities of what it means to be a journalist, what free speech means essentially in 1920. And interestingly enough, in terms of the propaganda campaign, his involvement attracts the attention of the Scottish Catholic hierarchy, who had otherwise been reticent on issues of Irish nationalism during this period, who issued a petition for his reprieve. And ultimately, he would be released from Pentonville on the 9th of August, 1920. So this is basically censorship in action and an Irish Catholic example of the ongoing press war against the British state.
Now, you've mentioned the Labour Party policy. Mo, can I bring you in on this? How important is the Labour Party to our discussion here?
The Labour Party is very important because it's a really great example of how the Irish conflict in these years becomes a way of thinking through empire and colonialism as well, and becomes a kind of test case, I guess, for how imperialism should be dealt with, for how the British presence around the world should be thought about. And so it was really within the Labour Party that some of the strongest links between the Irish conflict and anti-colonialism were made. And I want to be careful that I'm not saying that was the Labour Party's official stance, because it absolutely wasn't. But within the Labour Party, at some of the demonstrations and within some of the local labor groups, there was this really clear analysis of Ireland as an example of the kind of moral bankruptcy of colonialism and empire more generally.
Just kind of bring Angus in on this, Angus, because was the Irish situation always framed in those terms, though? You know, in other words, the terms of general global anti-colonialism.
Not really. I mean, I don't think at all. I mean, I think the and certainly the interpretation still remains one that tries to keep Ireland out of its kind of anti-colonial framework. I would say not. And I think in that sense, that's all.
So there's a certain contradiction there. Sorry, Mo, you want to come back in on that?
Yeah, I guess just to kind of highlight the diversity of ways that Ireland's being used, right? So for some activists within Labour, it's being used as, you know, look, Britain is imposing dictatorial government, is suppressing the rights of ordinary people in Ireland, in India, in Egypt. And it'll be the British workers next, right? That's sort of one line of analysis that's happening. But yeah, I mean, I guess I wanted to say that I think Angus is absolutely right. Ireland is also used in a lot of different ways in a lot of other contexts, so that it becomes also a way of trying to argue, for instance, within some liberal circles for what becomes the Commonwealth, for what becomes ideas about white self-governing dominions. And so there's another line of analysis going on here that's about actually Ireland's been miscategorized and should be understood as more like Canada, as more like South Africa, as more like Australia, and should be seen as part of a white self-governing set of dominions.
Well, that was the British definition of self-determination, the official British definition of self-determination. Yeah. Sorry, Angus, you want to come back in?
I would absolutely concur with what Mo is saying there, but I would also say that there is this lineage of anti-colonialism in the background to Irish nationalism that really gets going after the Boer War. So a figure like Alice Stopford Green, for instance, returns from her investigation of a prisoner of war camp on St. Helena in 1900. And she makes some very definite, serious anti-imperial, anti-colonial statements about military violence. And that then you can see re-emerging in 1910 when Robert Lind and his mother-in-law, Nanny Dryhurst, together with Sylvia Lind, organized Nationalities and Subject Races conference over 2 days in London, which draws together anti-colonial forces from not just around the British Empire, but also from Finland and Georgia and nationalities who are rising up against Russia. So you can see that Ireland is also being used as this way by which a whole number of different anti-colonial issues can be opened up. But I think that's a history that in many ways hasn't yet been teased out enough. And I think in that sense that looking at an organization like the Peace with Ireland Council that clearly does draw in a number of figures who, as Mo says, were relatively moderate before the war, but they were radicalized through their experience of the war. And certainly the treatment of Ireland after the war turned someone like Childers, for instance, from being a moderate nationalist imperialist, Irish nationalist imperialist, into a Republican who was prepared to go the whole length, the whole way, and die for the Republic.
Just want to go back to Mo, just on the Labour Party again. I mean, Mo, was it easy for the Labour Party to posture on these issues? I mean, it wouldn't be in government until 1923.
You know, I would say not, actually. I think that there was absolutely posturing happening within the Labour Party, but there's an interesting kind of story that happens within the Labour Party about how much they really want local membership to be weighing in on issues of foreign policy. And so there's this wave in 1920 of resolutions being passed by local branches saying, we support Irish independence and we're concerned about Egypt as well. And we think we should maybe have a general strike in order to voice sort of the British working people's anger at this situation. And the Labour higher ups, so at the level of the Parliamentary Labour Party, they're quite uneasy about that, actually. And they're concerned about the idea that a general strike might be used in matters of foreign policy. And they're especially concerned about looking electable and looking like a party that could govern the nation.
Plus a change, I can say about that. Yes, we've been disappointed with the Labour Party in government several times, especially here in Ireland, right? But Dara, can I just go on to you, like, just to, again, teasing out the Labour connection here. What were the connections with the ISDL and Irish groups in general with Labour?
Well, there are a couple of different strands to this. I just thought I'd kind of return basically to what Mo and Angus have been saying as well in terms of the links to anti-colonialism. And I think one of the interesting things about Irish links to other groups that very often these were framed by British political leaders or by British publicists or propagandists. And the term that's very often used by British propagandists during this period, of course, is Sinn Féin Bolshevism, this hyphenated identity, which is kind of pushed in the British media, pushed by people like HBC Pollard, who is a British propagandist, CJC Street in their publications. And this kind of filters out into the mainstream press as well. But at the same time, we do have to acknowledge that, especially in places like Glasgow, there were connections between members of the Sinn Féin organisation there. They didn't go by ISDL. And people like, John McLean, William Gallagher, and members of the Red Clydeside movement. But most of the information we have on that really comes from British intelligence reports. So for example, Basil Thompson, who was the Home Office Directorate, head of the Directorate of Intelligence, writes these weekly reports on revolutionary organisations in the United Kingdom, and he submits them to the British Cabinet for their review. And in these reports, he's basically juxtaposing Irish nationalist organisations like the ISDL and Sinn Féin with everything from the Red Clydeside movement to, other political subversives, the Communist Party, of course, of Great Britain and so on. And he does these in kind of very subtle ways. He notes that there were Sinn Féin flags at the Red Clydeside rallies in Glasgow and so on. And while there were connections, I think it's important to recognise that these were not necessarily recognised by the leadership, certainly in London. But to go back to your point, Tommy, regarding the connections to Labour, I mean, I've previously characterised the ISDL, I suppose, as a kind of conservative Gaelic movement, which was somewhat out of place, in the British political mainstream. But I think we have to recognise that there was a transition over time of that movement, and they became more adept at using propaganda in British political terms and using the British political language to convey their message. And a very good example of that, I think, is what I've elsewhere characterised as a radical moment which transcends the Irish Sea, and that occurs in the spring of 1920, wherein we see, for example, the Mountjoy prison strike, for example, when 60 prisoners at Mountjoy Jail were arrested, went on hunger strike, and Sinn Féin and the Irish Labour Party launched a general strike, which is tremendously successful. And the ISDL actually, in May of 1920, decided to use the same modus operandi, which is protest outside a prison, outside Wormwood Scrubs prison, where there had been dozens of alleged IRA prisoners interned since the turn of the year. Now, what's quite interesting here is that, unlike in previous months where they'd refused to work with Labour at a high political level, here they are picketing outside the Wormwood Scrubs prison. They're using the language of Labour radicalism. And in some respects, they're joining panels and platforms with Labour political leaders, especially as this led up to the May Day demonstrations in London. And it reaches a real peak of disaffection and discontent across the United Kingdom in early May of 1920. Most prominently, I suppose, the Liverpool Irish Self-Determination League issued an ultimatum to the British government on the 27th of April, threatening to call a strike of the city's some 217,000 Irish workers within 48 hours if the internees at Wormwood Scrubs were not released. And I think what's really important here to recognise in terms of the importance of British politics and British radical politics to the Irish Revolution is that British political leaders take this tremendously seriously. Basil Thompson, who I mentioned earlier, writes a report saying that despite the impact of what's happening at Mountjoy, the most disturbing factor has been the development of Sinn Féin activities in England. And he links the Battle of Mountjoy, as he terms it, with the battle outside Wormwood Scrubs. And ultimately, this radical moment does not fully materialise into a revolutionary moment across the Irish Sea. But I think it marks a point of inflection whereby Irish political leaders, otherwise reticent to engage in British political party politics or radical politics, recognise that this is a discourse, a British political discourse that they can use to their advantage. And it certainly highlights the case for Ireland during this period. Michael Collins, the most prescient observer of the day, states that Wormwood Scrubs will form the rallying point for the hitherto lost or unknown members of our exiles abroad.
Now, Moll, can I go back to you to look at the 2nd of July 1921 demonstration? Because this was, it wasn't just the Peace in Ireland Council, it was organised in conjunction with the Women's Freedom League. Who or what was the Women's Freedom League, and what's its significance to our discussion?
Sure, yeah. So the Women's Freedom League grew out of the International Committee of Women for Permanent Peace, which then became the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom. And that was founded out of a Congress of Women that was held in April 1915. So in a way, that brings us back to the conversation we started with, talking about pacifism and objection to the war. So there's this split in feminism and the suffrage movement in Britain over World War One, and there's the side of feminism that embraces pacifism, then found this organization, the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom. Right after World War One, it had about 4,200 members and 51 branches around the world, and it was part of that broad coalition we've been talking about that was advocating for peace in general, and then specifically for peace in Ireland throughout 1920 and 1922. They were involved as well in what Angus was speaking about, this effort to find out information, to find out what was actually happening in Ireland, and to bring that information back to Britain, with the idea that if British people only knew what was actually being done in their name, they would protest this war. So the Manchester branch of this organization sent a delegation to Ireland and then used those sort of findings to energize meetings really across England. There was also a special women's meeting against reprisals in Ireland in March 1921 in London. So I guess there's a really strong presence of kind of coalitional work with feminists to advocate for a negotiated settlement in Ireland. And this demonstration is one manifestation of that.
Dara, just very quickly, was there much female involvement in the ISDL?
I think the ISDL is pretty representative of Irish nationalist politics of the day, including Sinn Féin back in Ireland, that there was a gesture towards, you know, women's involvement. So they had women on platforms. Charlotte Despard actually, stood on some ISDL platforms, most notably at the Albert Hall. And Mo, of course, has written extensively on this specifically. But what I would say is, while they weren't as visible, let's say, as the Peace with Ireland Council or even the Labour Party, for example, I think if you look through the sources, British intelligence reports, contemporary newspaper reports, you find that post-1918, women were actually quite active and visible and voluble in crowds. And a lot of the sources that I've come across in Glasgow and London, they record the responses of crowds and say that women were quite prevalent, were quite prominent in crowds. So I think it's in the public spaces, not necessarily the platforms, but in the open public spaces, where, to Mo's point about the importance of associational culture, women sought to take an active part in those ISDL meetings.
Now, Angus, just going back to that demonstration again, of 2nd of July 1921, how big and how effective was that demonstration?
Yeah, I mean, it was a big demonstration, and it was effective in the sense that you could argue within a week a truce was signed or came into being, and the war to some extent came to an end. And I think a big show of support for peace in Ireland in central London must have had some impact on the politics of the day. But I think there are, I'd just like, in a way, to speak to those responses that Mo and Dara have just given, that there are, I think there are sort of really key women involved in the Peace with Ireland Council who haven't really been given enough oxygen. And I mean, Charlotte Despard, who did speak in early July in Trafalgar Square. But again, the figure who I think is really interesting to consider here is Alice Stopford Green. And Maura Comerford's memoir that has just been very well edited by Hilary Dully and published by Lilliput Press, she talks about Maura Comerford typing out the truce in the dining room of Alice Stopford Green in Dublin. And then Green immediately heading over to London to greet De Valera and others as they get off the train at Euston as part of the peace delegation. And so what I think you have here is a coordination happening between London and Dublin with regard to the emergence of a dialogue of peace in the summer of 1921. And I think that is that's an important thing to consider. And of course, Alice Stopford Green, in July 1921, published her final political pamphlet called The Government of Ireland, with a foreword by George Russell, AE, where she didn't hide in any way her sympathies for the eventual emergence of a republic, but also she was highly critical of the 1920 Government of Ireland Act, because she felt that it had, really been passed without any significant Irish say in the matter at all. And so she was very critical, really, of how Ireland had been treated by Britain from 1919 through to this peace settlement. But Alice Stopford Green, in the end, was a pacifist. And what's interesting, the fact that comes through the Maura Comerford memoir, is how you see in that moment the kind of high table of discussion in around Ireland being split between those who just couldn't continue with war on any terms. A figure like Alice Stopford Green, who was really always a pacifist, but had just been drawn into war through the circumstances of the time, and someone like Maura Comerford, who in the end, became very vocal on the anti-treaty side and felt that, the treaty was was just an imperial solution to England's Irish problem.
Now, Angus mentioned that the truce came about a week or so after that big demonstration. Mo, with the truce and with the subsequent negotiations, did the PIC feel this work was done?
Largely it did, yeah. The Peace with Ireland Council accepted the treaty and thought the negotiated settlement essentially drew drew their work to a close. They did have a brief kind of resurgence in the context of the Civil War when Erskine Childers was executed. They sort of reorganized themselves briefly and tried to argue for clemency for him. But that was really a more kind of return to using their networks to try to save somebody who'd been part of their world, their friendship world, really, rather than a return to political advocacy as such. They tended to view the Irish Civil Wars, I guess, outside their mandate, right? It wasn't something that they got that involved in. So they wound up in essence over the course of 1922.
Okay, Dara, can I just throw the same question to you in relation to the ISDL? How did that organization handle the treaty and the subsequent civil war?
Yes, well, so similar to Mo, there was an element certainly felt among the ordinary members of the ISDL that the work was done, so to speak. And that's very clear in terms of membership. For example, in March 1921, the ISDL has a membership of 38,000, which is really its peak membership throughout the War of Independence, at the height when their organization is being attacked by the British media, members are being arrested and so on. Yet 1 year later, in March 1922, that number had fallen to 20,405 members. There's also an ongoing wrangle within the ISDL as to, you know, whether they should vote for or against the treaty. Art O'Brien, who's the kind of essential figurehead, is passionately advocates to vote against the treaty. He had been somewhat involved during the treaty negotiations, more as a kind of as an aide-de-camp to people like Michael Collins and so on. But others felt that because this was, they were more of the view that self-determination meant any form of self-government for Ireland, that the treaty was respectable and that they weren't as vociferous in their support of the Republic. In Glasgow, the Scottish Sinn Féin, however, was a little bit different because, again, they adopted the title Sinn Féin, they maintained it, and so therefore they were more Republican. And they decisively opposed the treaty at executive level, 99 votes to 16. I think more broadly, you could say that certainly once Collins, Griffith and the other plenipotentiaries left London, the kind of political discourse had shifted from London to Dublin, and that Civil War politics was there from December of 1921 in everything in terms of, you know, the place of discussion had changed, the location of discussion had changed from London to Dublin, the kind of the minutiae of Irish nationalist politics in 1922 about, you know, article number or draft treaty number two, et cetera, were very different from the kind of big political discussions which were happening in Britain in 1921. And of course, we see this kind of division really manifest itself in the most disastrous ways in June of 1922, when two members of the London IRA, who were also somewhat attached to the London Irish Self-Determination League, Reginald Dunne and Joseph O'Sullivan, carried out the assassination of Sir Henry Wilson in central London. And this really marked the end of any sense of solidarity on the part of everyday Irish nationalists with the Irish Republican cause.
Actually, Dara, you've just teed things up nicely for a later hedge school we're having at the big Irish Civil War National Conference in UCC on the assassination of Sir Henry Wilson. And all of those issues you've just mentioned, no doubt, will come up again. Listen, we have to wrap this up here. I'd like to go to Mo maybe for the final point of this, Mo, just to answer the question I posed at the outset. How effective at the end of the day was or were organisations like the Peace in Ireland Council?
They were surprisingly effective. I think that there's a fairly broad historiographical consensus, actually, that David Lloyd George's decision to turn to negotiation rather than increasing military efforts in 1921 was based in large part on what he saw as the public opinion turning against how he was handling Ireland, that the Irish conflict was becoming something that was going to damage his ability to stay in office, that was damaging his government and his reputation. And that was partly fueled by the press and the kind of unanimity, emerging unanimity in the press that the cycles of reprisals and the military force in Ireland was unacceptable. But that in turn was fueled by these groups that were bringing back information that wasn't being easily shared from Ireland itself, that we're organizing arguments against the conduct of the war in Ireland, and that we're making use of these often really high level elite contacts in order to argue for a turn to negotiation instead. So I think Lloyd George's decision to negotiate the treaty in 1921 really can't be understood without this context of civil engagement and civil resistance to the conflict in Ireland.
Well, thank you for that. I'll leave you with the last word on that. I'd just like to thank our speakers here today, Dara Gannon, Angus Mitchin, and Mo Moulton. Now, this is our first high school since the Russian invasion of Ukraine. So a word of solidarity with the hard-pressed people of Ukraine is in order. And following on from today's theme, in particular Mo's closing remarks there, our today's theme of anti-imperial solidarity in the metropole, a word too for those Russians who are putting themselves at risk in expressing opposition to that war. Let's hope that in that regard, history, you know, does repeat itself. Now, for our next head school, to mark the centenary of the McMahon murders in Belfast on the 24th of March, 1922, we'll be looking at Northern Ireland in 1922, both before and after the outbreak of the Civil War in the South. Thank you all for listening, and I hope you can tune in then. Thank you very much.